Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. This is the first time ever podcast where I'm going to actually have two other guests on today. And I have our first guest, Patrick Bafuma, and then I'm going to have our second guest, Frank Norman, introduce themselves. Patrick, will you go first?
Hey, good morning, Chip and Frank. I'm Patrick. I'm a physician assistant in New York. And I also have a blog, eminfocus.com, as well as tweeting by the same handle.
And then Frank?
Good morning. My name is Frank Norman. I'm a PA working in emergency medicine, and I'm from the Society of Point of Care Ultrasound. And you can reach us at spacus.org.
Perfect. And I do want to mention that at least one of us has come off shift. One may still be in his boxers and the other one we don't know. And I'm not going to tell you who's who. So we're recording this at 4 a.m. right now because that seemed like the best time for our schedule. So thank you guys for working this out. We have an interesting paper that actually Patrick already has covered on his website, but was gracious enough to talk it out to the rest of us. And this paper, Patrick, I'll let you introduce it. Can you tell us a little bit about this paper?
Yeah, so this paper just came out in Chest. It is point of care ultrasound for evaluation of acute dyspnea in the emergency department. This is a single center Italian study. It was published, I believe it was this February of 2017 in Chest. They basically took 10 emergency department providers and they did an H&P. Vital signs and an EKG on all comers with acute dyspnea from all acuities. Anyone over age 16 that said, I'm here because I'm short of breath, or maybe they came in respiratory distress, all of these patients after the H&P, vital signs, and an EKG, they all had a point of care ultrasound. And these two groups, or the EP and the sonographer, were then blinded to the others' workup. So the ultrasound, the sonographer then filled out a form that said, I think this patient has ARDS, they have a PE, they have ACS, they have a PE, they have a tamponade, and basically put it in an envelope. And then the EP actually ordered additional studies based on whatever they thought was reasonable. So a chest film, a chest CT, a cardiologist performed echo in the emergency department, which I think is absolutely hysterical. And then labs, including an ABG if they want. And the results here are pretty amazing.
So actually, let's go over a couple of key terms here, because for those of you who may not be used to the minutiae in some ways of papers, when we talk about EP, it's usually emergency physician or emergency provider. The cardiologist echo is actually, like Patrick said, is a pretty rare thing to see, especially in a study like this. But in most departments, we're usually not going to have a cardiologist come down and do an echo. Weirdly enough, one of my shops that actually does happen, they're a little more old school, and they actually have cardiologists who'd sometimes come and do it. Again, it's still a pretty rarity, but we occasionally have that happen, or we'll have one of the echo techs come in and do it. But either way, it's a rare thing to actually have an echo done in the department. That's usually something that's going to be done more on an inpatient basis. So this is one of the big things I think that POCUS is really kind of a big factor on, because these are some of these studies are not done at all in the emergency department, at least not in most shops. And for us to be able to turn around and say, okay, we're going to have like basically the best case scenario, this is a huge part of the study. So that's why I really love the results and what they actually show. So Patrick, what were the results?
They do this really great table at the end of this paper, where they go over all the sensitivities and specificities, positive and negative predictive values for everything they were looking for. So you look at something like heart failure, negative predictive value, 94%, positive likelihood ratio of 32. Acute coronary syndrome. Now, this is like bedside echo for these sonographers and for the EPs, but specificity, 99.7%, negative predictive value. Normal echo, 99.3 negative predictive value. So, and positive likelihood ratio of 173. And these are insane numbers.
Now, here's one question, because I know, especially in the acute coronary syndrome, someone's going to ask this question, because everyone got EKGs. Was it the ultrasound picked up things that the EKG didn't, or is it just in conjunction with the rest of the exam? Because they did pick up more ACS with the ultrasound group than the regular workup group? Because I couldn't find that answer. I didn't see anything specific there. I assume it's a combination there. But either way, it shows they got more positives. So
they do these really nice charts on diagnostic accuracy of the ultrasound diagnosis and then the diagnostic accuracy of the ED diagnosis. But, you know, the ED diagnosis had the CAT scan. They had the echo read by the cardiologist in the department. They had the labs back. So they had a lot more data points. But then they do this data set with the diagnostic accuracy of point-of-care ultrasound and positive likelihood ratio for ACS, 105. But now this is with the sonographer who has the history and the physical and probe in hand. They see, maybe they see a wall motion abnormality. That's it. They call it ACS. That's their diagnosis. Right. And their positive likelihood ratio for that's pretty good at 105. I mean, compared to, say, a pericardial effusion, you know, 325, negative likelihood ratios of 0.14 for pericardial effusion, 0.12 for heart failure, pretty good negative predictive value there. And so I'm not going to go through all of these likelihood ratios, but, you know, some of these are in the hundreds, in the thousands for pneumothorax, 345 for PE if it's positive. I mean, these are things that you just do not get with physical exam. So this really, really bumps up your accuracy and can rapidly rule in and to some extent rule out. And I think at this point, I'm going to pass it over to Frank to talk about how easy some of these are. I mean, these numbers are just astounding, things that you don't get by H&P. So Frank, how easy is it to perform, say, pneumothorax?
I would agree that you know, not just that pneumothorax, but really many of these are among the easiest ultrasounds to actually learn how to perform and the quickest to do at the bedside. And, you know, one of the characteristics of the study, or one of the numbers that sort of jumps out at me at the study, was, first of all, that the guys who were using the ultrasound arrived at their diagnosis in 24 minutes as opposed to 180 some minutes for the other providers that were using the full workup and all these other sort of resources at their disposition. So it essentially took an eighth of the time for somebody with an ultrasound to arrive at all comers who have dyspnea, whether that dyspnea comes in from a pneumothorax or from acute coronary syndrome or CHF or pneumonia or ARDS, or some of these even apparently had malignancies that they were able to find. And to have that sort of that type of accuracy in that time frame, I think is amazing. But again, getting back to how easy this is, it's as easy as picking up a probe that's a curvilinear probe and simply putting it in on the chest wall, and seeing things like B lines, or we're seeing lung sliding going back and forth. It's that easy. And if I could, for somebody who's new, if I could give them a piece of advice on how to start with this, I would start with, you know, don't try to differentiate between coronary syndrome and pulmonary embolus and COPD and all these other ones. Just start off trying to figure out whether somebody has CHF or they have COPD. And again, that's one of the simplest things to do, by just putting a probe on them. And if they have B lines on both sides, which are very easy to see in somebody who has fulminant CHF, you're going to be able to see it very easily.
If I may, Frank, I'd include a couple of tips there from my own experience. And one of them is actually learn how to do this scan, even from sources online, like the Ultrasound Podcast. They do a lot of great reviews. We'll include some links in the show notes on some of their examples of lung ultrasound, because it's actually really easy to learn and really easy to do. But one of the things is, when you're first starting out, because keep in mind, in this study, and Patrick, I'm sure you noticed this too on the study, everyone they used, and they called this one of their limitations, had at least 2 years of experience using bedside ultrasound. So these are pretty experienced people, but not overly like experts, you would say. You know, some people would probably have done a lot more than others, but given that 2 years experience and you've figured out how to separate a lot of these conditions, that's a really good sign that it's something that's still very easy to pick up. For me, that tells me that this ultrasound technique is one that's easy to use and easy to utilize, But at the same time, it's going to take you a little bit of time. You're not just going to pick up the probe and magically figure that out. Like Frank's saying, you want to start with something more basic, but also start with people you have a confirmed diagnosis on. Go back, look at the ultrasound then, and see what makes that different from a normal lung ultrasound. And you'll start putting these pieces together fairly quickly. One thing I had a question for you, Frank, about, since we're talking about ultrasound this stage and about using it and figuring it out. You mentioned the curvilinear probe, but do we have to put this on a particular setting? Like, I know the ultrasound podcast guys say, well, you need to get on a lung setting. And I know my ultrasound machine doesn't actually have a specific lung setting, so it makes it a little bit harder to pick up things. Is there another one you'd recommend?
The setting that I personally use is the abdominal setting to pick up things like B lines. The reason is that actually the lung setting is really made to look at sort of the superficial portion of the lung, and they're specifically looking for lung sliding for a pneumothorax. The other pearl that I would sort of give or a piece of advice is any adjustments that you've made to sort of enhance the picture, TDI, or if you've adjusted the image in any way, take all that artifact off, because really what you want to do is to be able to see sort of the image in its purest form. So ultrasound machines from years ago were actually probably even easier to be able to find some of those lung findings, because they don't have all these settings which suppress the artifact that comes off of being able to sort of look at the lung. Because keep in mind, we're not really looking at the lung tissue. Lung ultrasound is really about sort of looking at artifact as opposed to actually seeing a representation about of the actual tissue, except in the form when we're looking at an effusion, or if we're looking at a lung consolidation with bronchograms and those things. But for the most part, we're really looking at artifact. Removing those settings sometimes helps to highlight those artifacts so that they're easier to see.
I think that's a really important point, because that's one thing I had a real struggle with myself on, trying to figure out how I was going to look at ultrasound for the lungs. Because with ultrasound of most things, you know, for example, the heart, or looking at the gallbladder, or any of those other things, you're not looking at for an artifact. You're actually looking for the anatomy. Lungs are different because you're actually relying on basically artifact. And the only thing that comes close to that ultrasound wise that I can think of off the top of my head that even comes close is actually looking for fractures on long bone. So you can actually look for the disruption of the cortex. And that's about the next closest thing. Lung ultrasound to me seems very different. And I think that's one of the barriers for people using it more, because they're still trying to figure out just what they're looking at.
I think you see a couple of people with CHF, and I think it becomes very clear, you know, what you're looking at. And the pleural effusion is a little bit strange at times, but you see a few when you have someone guide you for just a few to say, okay, this is what you see, or you have a few confirmatory studies with, you know, a CT or a film that's very clearly a large effusion from whatever. And I think then you kind of figure it out.
No, that's a good point. And I think for those of you who are practicing in a more rural setting, it may take you a while to actually see your positives. So it's all the more reason why to take a course or learn this from online resources wherever possible. But you definitely have to supplement, because it could be a long time for you to see a true positive finding for certain things. Now, CHF, pleural effusions, may not be that uncommon, but some of these, you know, a lot of them require a little extra expertise there. And tamponade is going to be one of those things you're going to look it up more than you're actually going to ever see it. Unless you're practicing in some areas, like, for example, in South Africa, where they tend to have a lot of tamponades for different reasons.
So, Chip, I just wanted to compare here for a second. I know at the beginning, we kind of threw out a bunch of numbers, and people may not necessarily grasp how astounding these are.
Yeah, are you going to talk about the likelihood ratios?
Yeah, so I mean, just for comparison here, if you go on the NNT, they have a bunch of likelihood ratios for various things. But the one that stuck out to me more, that people probably know and may or may not love, is the heart score, right? Yes. So if you've got a heart score 7 to 10, these people are pretty high risk, right? Likelihood ratio for ACS with a heart score 7 to 10 is 13. So for someone that you're like, oh God, this patient probably has a really high risk of having an ACS, you're not even in the same ballpark with these ultrasounds. I mean, 13 is one of the higher ones that I've seen before. And then, but you get into the hundreds and it's just, it just blows my mind. I can't get over how impressive, you know, a positive likelihood ratio of, you know, 300 for pulmonary embolism is, or for 300 for pericardial effusion.
The most ridiculous number was pneumothorax, 4,600.
Yeah.
Like, how do you get a 4,600 likelihood ratio? That basically says if you see it, it is that.
Yeah. And then heart score 0 to 3, likelihood ratio or negative likelihood ratio of 0.2. And these are plenty of patients that you're considering sending home, right? So what's less than 0.2 here? Heart failure. You know, so if you are sending home patients with a heart score of 0 to 3, if you do not have B-lines, you can rule out heart failure. I mean, if you are taking your heart score to that level, you can take your ultrasound to that level because these numbers are much better. Pneumonia, 0.13. Pericardial effusion, 0.14. Pneumothorax, 0.12. I mean, if you do not see it, it's not there. So,
Patrick, why don't you give some of these numbers if you want to just, if I can suggest. For instance, the common sort of physical exam findings that people are using, for instance, egophony has a likelihood ratio of 8. Crackles is that we're always taught to do is 2. You know, ronchi is 1 for, and this is for pneumonia now. Coughing is 1.8. Fever is 2.1. For CHF, the highest likelihood ratio that I could find was an S3. And I'm going to be I'm a little ashamed to admit here, I don't know that I've ever heard an S3 before, you know, after working. But if you hear an S3, you've got a likelihood ratio of 57. JVD is 4.3. Lower extremity edema is 2.7. These are the things that, you know, you always get asked, well, does the patient have these things, you know, for CHF? And it seems like they suck to be able to really kind of differentiate between, you know, is this somebody who has CHF or is this somebody who has chronically swollen legs and they have pneumonia, in fact, or ACS or one of those other things?
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, the third heart sound is usually lub dub lub again, or S1, S2, S1 again, right? That's my third heart sound.
Yeah.
I mean,
I would like to point out that, there's probably some people who are listening to this who are probably thinking, like, what the hell's egophony? Is that the E to A change? I can't remember that. You know, just.
I agree.
There are some of these things. I was hoping you'd mention, like, percussion. Like, let's percuss the chest. How often do we do that these days?
And stick a giant needle in based on our
findings. Yeah, I think we need to just randomly stick a needle somewhere. We'll figure this out. That's how you get a liver biopsy. But no, I think a lot of these are great points. And I mean, Frank, you already basically made that point for us. And that's why I really appreciate this, because there are so many different views here about how to do this. But I think we all agree ultrasound is really the way we're moving. Whether or not you think ultrasound's that great, or whether you have some reservations for whatever reason, it's just too hard to figure out at first. I guarantee you, with these types of numbers like likelihood ratios, Patrick, if you don't mind for us, over 10, that's pretty significant. Less than 0.1, that's also pretty significant, right? I mean, those are guarantees.
Yeah, I mean, I challenge someone. The next time you see a splashy article that talks about how great, I don't know, TPA is, or talks about how great, you know, we found the Holy Grail, please pull these likelihood ratios. I mean, finding something above 5 is really, really, really rare. And something in the hundreds, I haven't been doing this forever, but the last 2-3 years since I've been trying to plow through papers like one a week, I've never come across something like this. I think that you just said that this was a small paper. This was actually, I think this is probably the largest 2,700 patients. Every single comer that they took they took everyone that came through the department that wasn't trauma. They didn't look at specific etiologies. They said, okay, what do we see? And how good are we? I mean, this is probably as close to a real world study you're going to see.
This paper reminds me of somebody who walks into a bar and says, I'll fight anybody.
Yeah, and does.
And wins. I mean, it really doesn't, you know, it doesn't say, well, you know, we want to exclude a certain patient population, or, you know, a certain disease process, or, you know, people who have you know, certain symptoms or findings, or it honestly just said, who's short of breath, just step up and I'll take you on. And I don't know that I can think of as sort of another paper that's sort of, or another study that's ever done that with anything in medicine, and has been sort of shown to be this successful.
Do we agree that the trauma, the excluding trauma, makes sense? To me, it makes a lot of sense.
I'll be honest with you. I don't really understand the you know, other than I thought would have tilted the sort of the finding sort of more in favor of POCUS. I think excluding him is almost a plus, because what are you looking for within trauma? You know, you're looking for, you know, the things that sort of POCUS really sort of does best. So if it's able to evaluate those things, aren't you sort of shading it towards POCUS? So the fact that you excluded trauma, I thought actually showed that it was, you know, that they were trying to be fair.
No, I agree. That was my thought with both that, and because what you're looking for in trauma are few, you know, it's not like, oh, someone came in trauma, oh, they have CHF. I mean, that's always possible, but realistically, you're looking at pneumothorax, tamponade, stuff like that. So for that narrow window, instead you have, like we said, basically undifferentiated dyspneic patients, and now you got to figure it all out. I think that's really impressive. So, and again, these likelihood ratios are amazing. When we talk about likelihood ratios, if we can get over 10, I mean, that's considered to be essentially a diagnostic test. If we can get less than 0.1, that's considered to essentially be a rule-out type study. Am I right about that, Patrick? Those are the right numbers, right?
Yeah, and let's be fair here. You never see those numbers in papers. I mean, if you see an LR of 3 or 4, it's like deemed to be incredible by a lot of people who are pumping the study. I mean, yeah, that just this is mind-boggling to me.
I think I don't know if you guys read or heard the MRAP episode last month with likelihood ratios, that they basically compared 2, 5, and 10 increases the findings of that disease process with that particular finding by 15%. So 2 would be 15%. 5 would be 30%, and 10 would be 45%. That increases that likelihood ratio. Getting up to 100 is almost.
I hadn't actually heard that. I mean, that makes sense. From, and that was what kind of paper for that?
That was MRAP. They just said, how do you, you know, what do likelihood ratios mean? I think in February of just last month, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so I think
those were the numbers that they were looking at: 2, 5, and 10.
Okay.
I think somewhere, either Casey Parker or Justin Morgenstern, I think one of them had put out a blog post on sort of explaining what likelihood ratios mean. I think it may have been Casey, but I may be getting things confused. I guess let's be honest here. I mean, these docs who are performing these studies are pros. I mean, they thought about doing this study in 2012 is when they submitted to do this. So they have been really, really honing their craft here. The question is this applicable to the rest of us? And I guess I'll kick this over to you guys. Is this applicable to us?
Frank, I'll let you go first on this. I'd be curious your opinion.
Well, I think it's definitely applicable to people who are starting out in POCUS, because there are a couple other studies that sort of validate this point. I'll give you an example. There's a guy by the name of Timothy Jang that loves to have these studies that he calls sort of these 10-minute studies. So essentially what he does is he gets novices who have never done ultrasound before, and he gives them 10 minutes worth of training and then sort of sees what the results were. And he did one for DVTs. So they essentially did 199 studies. Everybody or every patient that got a point-of-care ultrasound then got a consultative ultrasound. So out of these 199 studies that they did, they found 45 DVTs through the consultative ultrasounds. The consultative ultrasounds, the DVTs were found in consultative ultrasounds were also found in the point of care ultrasound. So with 10 minutes of study, every single one that was found in radiology was found at the point of care. The point of care also called an additional study positive, and the radiologist did not agree. They thought it was negative. Curiously enough, that patient came back a week later and was found to have a DVT. After 10 minutes of training, they gave him a sensitivity of 100% and a specificity of 99%, only because that the gold standard or the test of choice called negative, but again, it ended up being positive. There's another famous study that was done in, but actually 2005, this was not a new study. This actually took some medical students, first year medical students, and it compared them to cardiologists with a stethoscope. So it took these medical students, gave them 18 hours worth of training, and then compared them to how they would be able to sort of perform as compared to a cardiologist. And they took, I want to say it was 61 patients, and they had like 231 abnormalities that they found. Things like valvular disease, hypertrophy, enlargement, left ventricular dysfunction. And at the end of the study, what they found was the students found 75% of the pathology. The cardiologists that were board certified found 49% of the cardiologists. So these students, first year medical students, were able to find 50% more pathology than board certified cardiologists only because they had a handheld ultrasound. So I think it can be inapplicable. And frankly, I don't think it's that hard to do. I think it's actually fairly easy. And I would challenge anybody to consider how easy it is to learn how the heart functions or murmurs by just listening to it. Isn't it easier to do by actually seeing how everything works? It just makes more sense. And I think people process and learn easier when they're actually seeing it, as opposed to just trying to figure out what's going on by listening to the sounds.
I think that last part is something that really gets to me sometimes, because I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were talking about heart murmurs, and they were very descriptive about heart murmurs, about, you know, all these different systolic types and how they sound and where you listen to the lung. And I'm just thinking, I'm just happy if I figure out systolic versus diastolic, honestly. So I'm going to figure out by echo what we're looking at, or at least get a better idea. And to me, I think this paper is just one more reason to support why competency-based ultrasound is such an effective tool. I mean, these guys are experienced, they know what they're doing, but because of that, they can go through and they can be extremely accurate in their diagnosis. And I think it's one of those things why, if we're going to consider ultrasound as part of our, you know, routine, which we really should, we should also be considering it as basically an extension of the physical exam. To me, that's one of the big things that I think a lot of people have an obstacle with, is like, well, I'm not sure I can diagnose something with ultrasound, especially if they're new. Well, that's fine. Just think of it as an extension of your physical exam, and that will open you up a lot more. Because, I mean, realistically, things you listen to on the stethoscope, you listen to coarse lung sounds, listen to those crackles, you listen to, you know, heart murmurs, all those types of things can be somewhat vague and not give you a real exact definition. And with the ultrasound probe, all of a sudden you pick up things that you didn't even hear or you didn't see well, and it really changes your ability to diagnose.
I'm going to interject here for a minute, and I have a confession to make. I am not an ultrasound pro. I have long said one of the biggest mistakes I've made was when I was at an academic center that I didn't learn more about ultrasound when I had the chance. And I've really struggled for the past, I'm going to say 2 or 3 years, to try and figure it out. And I've gone to courses. I went off to a mini fellowship for like a week. And it was just really hard for me to apply to practice. And a large portion of that is because, honestly, most of the docs I work with think that I'm looking at the fuzzy snowman on the ultrasound machine and don't really know what to do with it. So I don't really have a ton of guidance. But what I've done is I instituted a rule. I call it the five towel rule. I go around for the last 3 months. Every time I'm on shift, I keep ultrasound right next to my desk. I've got five towels, and my goal is to scan five patients. And I cherry pick a little bit, and I pick every chest pain, every shortness of breath, every belly pain that I can find. And I just, everyone, I found that I was going through five towels in the first 2 hours. And then I also found you rapidly get better, and you are much, your views come into focus much, much more quickly. And you're going to see CHF. And it's a little disheartening initially, because you're like, you know, I think I see this, and you want to make a diagnosis, and no one else in your facility is using it. But then you do a few confirmatory CT scans initially, and that might be what you have to do to show to yourself and to everyone else, hey, this is going to work. And, you know, you're going to be right if you can't CHF. I'm not telling you to go look for acute coronary syndrome and do wall motion abnormalities. I think that's way above my abilities. But to find B-lines, you can do that. To find pleural effusions, you can do. To look at an IVC, you can do. To find a pericardial effusion, you can do. And these 10-minute studies you're talking about, these are all things that I've seen and have diagnosed. So it's, you just got to get over the mindset that you can't do it and just friggin' do it. Take five hand towels with you on shift. You will do it, and you just got to force yourself to bring it into every single room, because eventually it's going to matter. And for the 90% of patients, not going to change much, but you know, you're practicing for when those minutes count.
You must be cleaner than I am. I use five hand towels on one patient. So,
but maybe I'm not getting good views because I'm not using enough gel.
You got to use the gel. The more gel, the better. But no, I think that's a great point. That was the same obstacle I had. You know, Frank, we've talked about this before on a previous podcast, and we'll put that in the show notes too. But when you talk about competency-based ultrasound and getting, you know, basically getting the exposure to it, if you don't have that, what do we call it? The Yoda or what was it? Yoda or something else?
Your rabbi.
Your Buddha? No? That's some religious terminology that we're going to get in trouble with.
Your rabbi. Your rabbi, I think. Well, that's what they call it in the army. Is, you know, if you have a rabbi, it's the guy who looks over your shoulder and looks out for you. But okay. I think people get Yoda, though.
So you have your Yoda. But I think the big thing is that if you don't have someone like that, get the confirmatory studies and do kind of your own way. That's actually one of the best ways I got used to the EFAS exam, because the EFAS exam gives you so many windows so quickly. That and doing rush exams. We got the CTs each time to confirm afterwards whatever the appropriate study was. But it's amazing to look at what the normal or abnormal physiology is and be able to turn around and you know, compare that to your ultrasound and see. It's sometimes you get a little surprised on what you may have missed or what you may not have. It definitely changes your mindset. I've caught little pneumothoraces before that chest x-rays totally missed, and you know, CT helped confirm. And then I've had times where there's been things that I thought might have been positive, wasn't 100%. And then, you know, we got the relevant CT study. Now, given CTs are not perfect either, we've kind of talked about this before. It's definitely something I'll pay attention to. That's why I feel like ultrasound, I mean, just like you said, Patrick, just get over it and just start learning it. You know, don't be afraid of the machine just because you're not sure you can pick it up. I mean, at some point, we were all afraid of even picking up a stethoscope because we didn't understand what we were listening to. And we've gotten over that, and I think we're all realizing that maybe the stethoscope is what we need to put down. We need to start picking up the ultrasound machine instead.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're in PA school and you finally get over, do you have sex with men, women, or both? When you finally stop giggling after asking the question, it's about when you can start using the ultrasound machine.
So, Jeff, is that your recommended tip there? Is once you can ask the sexual questions, you can get to pick up the ultrasound?
Without smirking, yeah.
Without smirking.
So, Chip, how did you start learning? Do you have like a guru or a rabbi at your shop, or
guru?
Did you...
That was it. It was Guru and Yoda. It wasn't. Thank you, Patrick. So no, actually, this is kind of an interesting story. I learned a little bit of ultrasound when I was on rotations, because we did not learn it in my PA program, which I'm sure Frank would be happy to help educate all programs on how to incorporate ultrasound, because it's definitely needed. But one of the things I think we need to keep in mind is that a lot of us, when we have students, we need to be exposing them to ultrasound because it's probably their first time. And luckily, I had on my critical care rotation one PA who really got me involved with it, and I was really happy for that. But fast forward to my career, we were using it some for, you know, basic stuff like getting art lines and central lines and stuff like that. So I learned the vascular access first, and then I started getting more and more involved with emergency medicine procedures, but I didn't really have that guru. And my guru became the ultrasound podcast, which is why I endorse it so much. I get nothing from them, but I love that podcast because I learned so much from it. And I actually went to like a 2-3 day course, whatever SIMPA, however long that course is, I'm trying to remember, but I went to their inaugural course, and it was kind of interesting because they were really surprised at what I already knew going into it. But that made me feel good, not boastful, just made me feel good that I actually learned stuff just remotely and was picking up on my own. And I was kind of doing scans before I ever got there. So again, I was doing it mostly based on confirmatory studies. We do have one person who's pretty experienced with ultrasound in my place. And so when he's on, I'll talk to him, but a lot of times he's not. We just work slightly different schedules. So it's kind of nice to have that backup. And now more and more, I've just picked it up on my own. There are definitely studies that I'm not as good at. And I'm the first to recognize that. And I'm very cautious when I do those studies. But I'm doing it a lot of times, and I tell the patient I'm doing it to learn, and they're pretty happy with that. So, for example, biliary studies for me is still a bit of a weak spot. I still, as we're talking about this, I still have things to, definitely to learn about the lung and echo exams, just because there's a lot of fine points to get into the more nitty-gritty, you know, just beyond the B lines and stuff like that. And that's why I'm using as much alternative courses as possible. I feel like I'm endorsing Simpa all over the place today, but Simpa also has some classes coming up. So if you're listening to this podcast shortly, you know, after we publish it, Simpa does have both a basic, advanced, and they actually also have a procedures-based ultrasound course at their coming Simpa conference, which I'll be at, by the way. I don't know if you two are going to be at Simpa this year.
Patrick? I will not be at Simpa. What about you, Frank?
Unfortunately, I will not be.
It'll just be me there. Too bad.
If for any of the newer PAs that may be listening to this podcast, Frank, you're going to be at AAPA, right?
I am, Patrick. I'll be at AAPA, and I'll be giving a few talks on how to get a ultrasound program started for a student ultrasound interest section at your PA school, which is essentially an extracurricular activity that we can sponsor and get a mentor for you and at least get you exposed to getting some ultrasound education and hopefully use that sort of as a segue for your program to be able to fully incorporate it into their learning. And I'll be out. We'll have a table there also and just sort of out meeting people and trying to encourage them to pick up a probe.
Cool. I want to give a plug to Philippe Rolla out in Montreal. So
this was the thing you did, right?
I went up.
Tell us a little bit about this.
This is great. I actually, I want to try to get other places. If you have a PA residency program, or even if you don't and you're really excited about ultrasound, I really want to get other people to do this because this is something that's really needed. So what Philippe does, he has the Thinking Critical Care blog is what he does. And I kind of came across it on his blog and on Twitter. Is he has like a V-scan, so those little like handheld ultrasounds, and then he has a really nice fancy Alloka as well. But he you spend as many days as you want with him in the ICU, and he has like a 12-bed ICU. They're usually full, and you go around and you just live scan all of his patients, and they're ICU patients, so they have some pathology. And so if you want to do intestinal ultrasound, you want to do biliary, you want to do lung, you can scan this patient from head to toe as many times as you want. And then the other cool thing he does is he goes out on the met calls. So all of these like rapid responses, it's him. And he goes with the V scan in his hand, and you get to see this in live, in real time, like what he does. And you know, he is very, very willing to, he just hands you the probe and says, okay, what do you say? And then he takes all the consults from the ER and scans those patients. And it's really nice to kind of put it all together. And if you are at a site where you do not have your Yoda, where you don't have your guru, like this is really, really good to either reinforce what you do or to guide you a little bit to say, you know, you got to optimize this view a little bit. Let's work on this. And 3-4 days, it's not expensive. It's like $300 a day. So this fits well within a budget. There's not a lot of things that are like this at this price. So I would highly encourage, if you are an ultrasound savvy PA, this is a great, great, great way to help your profession and advertise it as well. So just throwing that out there, but highly, highly recommend going out to Montreal for to learn with Philippe.
No, I think that's great. I'm glad you had a great time there, because I know last time we were talking, you were still, you were getting ready to go over, but you hadn't gone over yet. So I'm glad you enjoyed that time up there.
Does he work with Maxime?
He does not, actually.
Okay. So Montreal this coming year is where the World Congress in Ultrasound and Medical Education is going to be held. So looking forward to going up there in October. I've never been up there, so to the Canadian land.
I think that this study, if anything, I don't think if you're looking at this study as, well, I can't do this because they had so much experience, I'm not going to get these likelihood ratios. Frank was just telling us about these 10-minute studies. You can do this. You're not necessarily going to see wall motion abnormality, but you can tell the difference between CHF and some pneumonias, perhaps. You can maybe see that this is pulmonary edema and not COPD exacerbation, and that will change your course of treatment. So this is more inspirational for me to say, like, hey, get out there, keep practicing, go through the hands howls. That's what this is saying to me.
I also think that that this is going to be a segue to a kind of a greater emphasis on evaluating dyspnea with an ultrasound, because there's no way after seeing something with a study with these kind of numbers that anybody's going to sort of walk away. I mean, this is certainly going to need to be validated by other studies and, here in the States and in South America and throughout the world to see if we get similar numbers and to see if maybe it's if this study is reproducible. But it's definitely not going away. When you look at some of the likelihood ratios that you see in the study and you compare them to the likelihood ratios that are taught to us in school that we spend so much time learning and sort of preparing for. And when you compare the likelihood ratios, for instance, for egophony at 8 and crackles at 2 and ronchi at 1 and cough and fever at 1.8 and 2.1, it's I think it'll definitely be helpful for people to realize that it's okay to start using the ultrasound to evaluate dyspnea, because it's better for the patient. It's faster for the provider. I think in the long run, it'll actually be cheaper too.
Yeah, I think this has a lot of positive benefits. And I mean, we've talked about it so much already, but I feel like we just have to say that this is a paper that we should actually take the time to read in detail and learn it, especially if you plan on trying to use this as a point of why we should have POCUS in your department. And say, hey, we can use this on our dyspneic patients. We can diagnose them more quickly, more accurately. Yes, these are people who have a fair amount of experience. I mean, again, they have at least 2 years of experience. But let's say that's just 2 years. I mean, I think all of us have already had a couple of years under our belt. Maybe not quite as extensive pathology as maybe some others do. But we get a lot of exposure, and all you have to do is just practice with everything. I mean, this is what it comes down to. Any skill that you're going to do, you're going to get better at with time, whether that's intubation, central lines, or POCUS, or anything else. You do this enough, you're going to start getting better at it. It's going to take some time, of course, but you're going to get better at it. And I think that's the big thing we keep forgetting is POCUS should be no different than any other skill. But it's also important that just because you have learned it, you don't ditch it. You don't use it less and less. I try and use POCUS daily because it's so beneficial to my practice in general.
There was a talk by Ressa Lewis. I always butcher her name, but she was talking about ultrasound's the first thing that has come out in decades that brings people back to the bedside. I mean, this actually boosts your patient satisfaction scores. Patients like it when you have more time at the bedside. They're seeing what you're seeing rather than throwing out words that they don't understand. Like, your white blood cell count is high. Yeah, your sodium's really off. They're like, that's not totally, it doesn't click. But if you show them, like, look, this is all fluid. Do you see it? Oh, okay. I think it clicks a little bit better. Patients are happier. And frankly, I am less drained at the end of the shift. The cognitive offload I experience, by saying, okay, here's what I'm doing, getting on a certain track early with a patient and not having to keep task switching and going back as labs drip back is huge. Anyway, I'm getting off topic here, but
no, I think those are all great points. Frank, do you have any kind of finishing points with this?
I think this is more validation that that we've really got to give a maximal effort to start integrating ultrasound very early on into our young graduates and our young students' education, because you know, if this study means anything to me, it means that we're spending time maybe teaching things that should get less emphasis and more time teaching things that maybe have bear sweeter fruit than maybe what we're spending right now. Because if you're spending 184 minutes trying to find the cause of somebody's dyspnea and somebody comes along with a new piece of technology that's able to do it in 24 minutes and is more accurate than you were, then you should probably pay very close attention to it and try to emulate it and try to incorporate that into the learning. So I'm hopeful that this will be a segue so that we can kind of continue the conversation and get this into schools and have faculty start teaching it.
Well, I think that's everything we've got covered today. Again, I want to thank Patrick and Frank for coming on to the show. As a quick recap, I will be at SIMPA for the PAs out there who are in emergency medicine. And if you want to talk a little more about whether it's a podcast or ultrasound, I'd be more than happy to meet and discuss with you. Frank will be at AAPA, and he will be happy to talk to you about ultrasound there. And Patrick also gets to be with me at the podcasting course in Lexington, Kentucky, where we'll actually be doing most of the learning ourselves on how to do podcasting, because I need to get better at it, and I think Patrick wants to be inspired to do his own thing too. We're going to be able to see you guys hopefully in the next few months. If you guys have any questions, of course, please let us know. We always have comments in the comments section. And if you need to email us, that's also good at thetotalem@gmail.com. Otherwise, I think it's time to call it a wrap. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.